Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted,
the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat.
Hi, this is Clive Russell, and this is Outlander podcast.
Welcome to episode 163 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander. So, announcements this week. Ginger has some cats in her room that are locked and don't like it. So we're probably going to be hearing a lot of them.
She's not torturing cats, people. Just know that.
They're locked behind a door. That's why they're freaking out. Well, not they. One of them.
Yes. But in other announcements, we had a big one this week. Actually, there was a giant spread in Entertainment Weekly. They got the cover, and it's a good picture. I may have to frame this one, you guys. It's nice.
It's a nice picture.
It's a real nice picture.
And hi all, by the way. I like the one with Tobias.
That's Lene. She's back for us with the read-along this week.
I'm a glutton for punishment.
She does. Oh, sorry. Yeah, that's right. This is our friend of the show, Lene.
Yay.
Hello, all.
But people become so normally, we're such friends that we don't even bother introducing them anymore.
We're all so rude.
Well, Lene just walked in, made herself at home.
No, to be honest, I was intending to do it once we got to the read-along, but...
Of course.
You know, that being
said. I see what you're saying.
I can't keep my mouth shut.
No, she's so. Just, nope. But the big announcement this week, they've cast old Fergus,
grown, older.
Dude,
older?
Just say adult.
Man Fergus.
I like Man Fergus.
Manly Fergus.
Manly
Fergus.
Sounds
and
good.
I'm not going to try to pronounce his name, so I'm going to give that over to Ginger.
Oh, Lord. And what Ginger came up with, and she's fairly... confident, and please, French speakers or students of French who have studied much longer than me, please correct me if I'm wrong. I believe it is César d'Ambois.
Now, the only thing I will say as a caveat to whether or not that is correct is that Stanley's name is Stanley Weber.
Yeah, but that is not a French last name.
It's not, but he's super French.
Stanley is hot. Not a...
Sorry, Stanley Weber is hot.
He is.
So hot.
Oh, very Lord hot. Have mercy. Could you imagine? I mean, he's a little bit old, but could you imagine if he were like adult Fergus? Holy ham basket. That is... Yeah. Whew.
Oh, he's too old to play adult Fergus right now.
I just said he's too old, but could you imagine?
Yeah.
Gracious.
Yeah.
Okay. But Fergus is nice, and...
I hope he gets his own spinoff. Have I said that?
Yeah. Oh,
I really hope Stanley Weber gets his own, like, spinoff.
Or something, yeah.
Like from Outlander, from one of the bulges, one of the books, you know?
I always like talking about Stanley Weber's bulge.
I totally did not mean to say that. That is not okay.
No, it's brilliant. There's nothing wrong with it.
Yeah. So that Fergus, we're looking forward to Fergus.
Well, anyway, César, we're just going to call you César.
César.
And I guess that's announcements this week. So let's move on to...
I'm sorry. It is what it is.
Oh, just play the music. We are discussing Chapter 8, entitled Honor's Prisoner.
So this chapter, it gives us a place and an exact date. Ardsmuir, Scotland, February 15th, 1755. So this would have been 9 years? Not quite 10 years after Culloden, right? So Culloden was 46, so this is not quite... This is like about not... Just under 9 years, actually.
So how many years since he turned himself in? Two?
If it was 6.5, 7... To 1.5, almost 2, maybe? Joe B. writes, Ardsmuir is isolated, near the coast, and on or near Mackenzie Land. It's not mentioned before, but I imagine its location means Jamie must have known of it. The chapter opens with, quote, Arzmur is the carbuncle of God's bum, unquote. Mm-hmm. What an interesting first line. This, of course, by Colonel Harry Query.
That just made me think of Harry Carey.
I know.
The sportscaster.
I know. Great, great name combo there. So we meet Major John William Gray. Woohoo! So this is, of course, adult John Gray. And it's his first day of his new posting. Two references to Scotland as a backside, the carbuncle on God's bum, and Query also says the backside of bloody Scotland. Now, Query also gives advice on how he's filling John in on how to best settle in, how the prisoners act, what the routine is like, how he can best run it, or how he's found what works best. And he tells him, he gives him advice on how to get cheap whiskey. Now, it's funny that his information transfer to prepare young Gray, he left him a distinct note that outlined the whiskey situation. So most of the stuff, I'm sure he tells him about files. He can go look at different or files or paperwork. There's a lot of paperwork. But the note he leaves them. And now Diana didn't mention anything else, but it's very possible there were other papers for him. But the only note that is referenced is about how to get good whiskey. Yeah. Which is pretty much needed. Number one, it's Scotland, so it's available. Number two, it's on the carbuncle of Bod's gum, God's bum. So
they made it very clear there's literally not much else to do.
Exactly.
Than drink.
Exactly.
Well, doesn't he ask like about society? There was a word in there that I never heard. And I'm like, I even got online and looked it up and I couldn't even really find a good answer for it because it had been used like during Shakespeare's times.
I may have looked it up. I think I know what you're talking about. I don't have it right here, but
let me see the book.
I may have, but I may not have.
He asked him about entertainment and society, and he's like, "What society?" kind of thing.
So normally Ardsmuir holds about 200 prisoners. Currently there are only 196. Quote, give or take a few deaths from sickness or the odd poacher taken up in the countryside, unquote. So interesting that people actually do successfully escape. There are 82 guards, though only about half of those are in use. They find solace in drink, and half are typically not able to work. Not that there's much work, but mostly for John, it's paperwork. So there is no clerk. He died a few weeks back. Corey's trying to sell it to John as get a clerk trained as quick as you can, and all you have to do, your job is maybe a little bit of paperwork, but you'll have all the time in the world to hunt grouse and the Frenchman's gold. Now, this, of course, refers to the gold that Louis of France had supposedly sent his cousin, Charles. The prisoners, he says, are mostly docile. Quote, there's no heart in them after Culloden, unquote. How sad is that line? I mean, it reminds me of like some, not all of them, thank God, but it reminds me of like some animals you might see on that ASPCA commercial with Sarah, what's her name?
Sarah McLachlan.
Yes. Like how? I can't watch those commercials. But that's what it made me think of. They're broken. And they just
now
have,
I'm
like,
imagining them all sitting on the floor and facing a corner and turning back around at the guards as they walk in.
Well, they are just like sad. They are like kind of a lot of them living on the floors and being bitten by rats and
oh gosh, yep.
Yeah, I mean it's pretty awful.
And the prisoners are also put to labor. Quote, we work them hard enough that they've no vigor left for troublemaking. Unquote. So they're not only broken and they have no heart left, no like not a lot of will to escape or to fight or to do whatever, but whatever they do have, whatever energy they do have, they break them through hard labor.
They work them to the bone.
Yep. The Scots were being used to renovate the fortress, and they also are used for peat cutting. He describes the men, quote, ragged as scarecrows, unquote. So these men who have no great will left after Culloden, and they're, you know, scarecrows. They're, yeah, like skin and bone, and their clothes are falling off, and they're flea bitten or rat bitten, and just, you know, holes. I just cannot imagine. And the men who are peat cutters, now they have knives, and so they're watched a little more closely than the others, say, doing some other kind of work.
Have you ever seen a knife they used to cut peat?
No, but is it scary?
Like a tiny scythe?
No, it's actually, at least the ones I've seen, I don't know if they're, I mean, it's just a tool, and it's metal, and it couldn't have evolved all that much through the years. So I imagine the peat cutters I've seen that aren't, you know, automated, or I don't know if they have automated peat cutters, but it looks like a square kind of, I don't know how to describe it. It looks almost like
a giant cookie cutter.
Yeah, almost. And they slide it down into the peat, and then they take it and they pop it out, and then they slide it down again and they pop it out. I don't think it has like all four sides to it, but it's almost like a giant square tube-shaped knife thing. I don't know how else to describe it. But yeah, it's like this, it's not a knife. At least the ones I've seen, maybe they weren't as advanced. Maybe they just used regular knives and they cut them with these like machetes or something. I don't know.
Quarry also tells him that because of the peat, even though it's cold and it's raining most of the time and the fire is going on the inside, still keep the window open at least partially, even when it's raining. Because otherwise, I mean, it's going to be so full with smoke and just a horrible, it will overcome you.
Peat fires are really bad.
They smell amazing, but yes, you don't want to be trapped with one.
No.
No, they had peat fires at the Highland Folk Museum.
Newton Moore.
And I didn't want to go into any of those buildings where they were heating them up because it was so pungent and it was so pervasive. Like, it was a lot.
I mean, what is peat anyway? It's just like decomposed like plant matter, right? That's,
I think so, yeah.
It's kind of like really compact, and then they dry it out and then they burn it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's got to be very smoky.
It's a very rich, and I'm not saying rich isn't positive necessarily, but it's very, you know, potent. Potent is a good word. But and it's definitely acquired. Yeah. I mean, you either like it or you don't. Maybe you can acquire it. I don't know. I don't like stink, but that one, I don't want to be, again, I don't want to be in a room with the door closed with it. Mm-hmm. You know, if it's smoky, like in those kinds of places, but if I'm around like in a pub and they have a peat fire going, but it's well ventilated, oh my gosh, there's nothing better than being in a Scottish pub or British pub with an authentic peat fire. And you don't have to be too close to it, but you can smell it. You're close enough to smell it. And it's cold outside and you have your whatever drink. I mean, whiskey, whatever. Oh my God. It's just, yeah. We learn that there's not much, quote, society here at the prison. A query says that there are, quote, one or two passable, I'm going to hope I'm going to say it correctly, Blowisabellas down in the village.
Yeah.
Unquote. Now, I did find that word, but that's, yeah. So his society, he tells him, will consist of four officers, an orderly, and a prisoner. Enter Jamie Fraser. So this is the prisoner who will be part of John's society here at Ardsmuir. Now, Gray stiffens at the announcement when he tells him it's Red Jamie Fraser. So a Blowisabella is, quote, an English band who play bagpipes, hurdy-gurdy, and an array of acoustic instruments to produce a driving drone-based sound influenced by British and European traditional dance music. Many of their tunes have become standards in the modern folk repertoire. Bands who experiment with the boundaries of folk music often cite Blowisabella as a major influence, unquote. And we'll include that link in the show notes as well. So, yeah, that was a new word for me.
That's every time I was searching it, it would bring up that band with that name. And I'm like,
oh, the name, okay, yeah.
You're not talking about this band. I know that.
Exactly. So John is kind of freaking out. He's like, oh, so Jamie is here. The other Highland prisoners, he learns, treat him as their chief. And he acts, in turn, as their spokesman. He is called MacDuv, short for the Gaelic for James, son of the Black One, unquote. The prisoners obey him, but Gray is told he must consult Jamie, at least tell him what's coming, if not, you know, not getting permission or even discussing alternatives, but letting him know at least, at the very least, what's going to happen so he can relay it to the others, or the men wouldn't listen. And Lisa T. writes, Lord John Gray, and we'll start right here, right now, that is LJG. So if we say LJG, it's Lord John Gray. LJG is mortified.
Can you just say LJ? There's no other LJs.
Or just Lord John.
How about John, Johnny Boy?
Johnny?
John.
There, yeah, are there any other Johns?
I don't know.
I mean, big name Johns.
I would be okay with just saying
Lord John. Lord John said all the time. Lord
very John, okay. Honest. LJG is literally the exact amount of syllables as Lord John Gray.
Yeah, when you're typing, it's a lot nothing. Easier.
I know, when but typing, when you're typing, it's speaking, a lot easier. When you're speaking, you
but
say
Lord
nothing.
John is Lord John is fine. So Lord John is mortified to learn that Jaime is at Ardsmuir after the incident at Prestonpans. Harry tells Lord John that he will need, quote, Fraser's goodwill or Lisa's cooperation, unquote. He suggests that Lord John have supper with Jaime once a week as he did. Quote, when icicles grew in hell, he might take supper with James Fraser, unquote. Again, the reference to hell. Ironically, they are in Scotland, the carbuncle on God's bum, remember? So icicles may grow in hell. He also warns him, quote, if you dine with Fraser alone, don't turn your back on him, unquote. We also learn that John has been posted to Ardsmuir as a punishment for a scandal involving an ex-lover. So John, like Jaime, is in hell. So that's not quite getting too terribly far ahead. We don't quite learn, I think, until a little bit later that, and it's not 100% confirmed, but it's a heavy hint that it's pretty straightforward that we know some kind of scandal brought John here. We don't know exactly the scandal, but after talking about later on Hector and everything, and he mentions George with this scandal, you can kind of put two and two together and say, okay, it was something to do with the dude, most likely.
Yeah.
So Corey brings up the fact that young Gray, when he was younger, was at Culloden with his brother's regiment. He does know about the tale, John finds out. And Corey had supper with
Jimmy. Are you talking about the tale of when he was a
16, yeah.
The 16, okay.
Corey, as Lisa mentioned, had supper with Jaime once a week, basically to keep in touch and to, that was a way that, not show respect to Jaime as the quote-unquote unofficial leader of the prisoners or the accepted chief of the prisoners. And also it helped the prisoners, you know, give a word. He was like their instrument, their leader and their instrument. He was able to be like a gopher, a liaison. And he tells John, look, he's educated. He plays chess. You know, definitely, you know, keep him on your good side. You want to keep this thing going. And before he leaves, Query does warn him, though, I'm not going to say that because Lisa already said it. Okay. Query says that there's intelligence and then there's hate. And this is about him not dining with Jaime alone. He says there's been a great deal of that. The hate in Scotland the last 10 years. So, Jaime has been in a... I wrote down, Jamie's been in prison approximately 3 years. So he says 10 years. I think he's like rounding up because the date in here was February 1755. Culloden was April 1746. So we're not even 10 years out from Culloden. It's not even 9 years out from Culloden. It's just 2 months under 9 years. So...
But things started getting bad for the Scottish before...
That's true. Because it was in 45, it's called the 45. So yeah, 45 is when it started. So yeah, that's true. Okay. But he has not been in prison for 10 years. No. Sorry, even 3 years. More like two and a half is stretching it. So John is 26, we find out. He has a fair complexion and girlish lashes. He was an inch or two shorter than the average, and he was fine-boned. So he's got a lot of things against him for maybe being like some manly man at that time in the military. He comes from a good family, so that's what's going to save his hide probably a lot of the time.
What was the average height back then? Because Jaime was above average.
Oh, heck yeah.
Jaime was a Viking.
So if the average back then, because average now for guys is generally around 6 feet tall, I would think. Mm-hmm.
And back then, average? Oh, Lene, my dad's about average and 5'9".
Like 5'9", 5'10".
That's average for men?
Yeah.
Maybe 5'10", but not...
I am, per Google, the average height of a white female in the United States.
Are you really?
I am 5'4 and 1/2".
You short.
It specifically says 5'4 and 1/2".
Well, then...
So what does that make me, a freak?
Of nature.
An Amazon.
I'm almost 5'8". Huh. So he probably would have been like 5'8". He probably would have been fairly small for a man.
I mean, he's still taller. I mean, we don't know this now, but he's still larger than Claire, and Claire was supposed to be 5'6" at the time.
Yeah, that's true. So if Claire was 5'6", and he's 5'8", let's say 5'7", 5'8".
I would say let's say 5'7", because I don't think if the average now, I didn't hear you guys say the man, let's just say the average man now is 5'8". If that's, and this is not for the UK, but for the US, if it were 5'8", or if it were 5'9", now, people have been getting, if I'm not mistaken, have
really,
been getting
taller.
Really?
That's the average height for men in the United States? I must just hang around tall men.
You do.
You do.
I've met them all.
Because I just like...
Well, you come from tall stock,
short.
So...
I know, but seriously, that seems small. What's the... Okay. All right, if you guys say so. I'll believe
I mean, I don't know. I'm not reading anything about that. I'm not looking that up. I'm just saying I've grown up with this idea of 5'9 being average. I mean, it's considered short, but it's because, you know, they're, yeah.
So how tall are you, Ginger?
5'8".
5'8", yeah. You're a little bit taller than me. I'm just
I don't
under,
think so.
Yeah, I'm a little under 5'8".
David Barry, who is playing Lord John, is 6'1", so he will be a little shorter than Sam.
Whoa, he's taller.
He's tall.
Yeah, and he's taller, a little tiny bit taller than Katrina.
Katrina's not 6 feet. He's at least 2 or 3 inches taller than Katrina.
No, I know. She's not 6 feet.
That's more
than
a little bit.
No, but I think she's technically 5'9". Maybe 5'10", but she's not much taller than 5'10".
Okay, so...
she always wears heels, at least outside. So, Quarry leaves him with, quote... God knows what you did to be sent here, but for your own sake, I hope you deserved it, unquote.
I hope it was worth it.
Exactly.
So, Lisa T. And Corey got in. Corey mentions him having been involved in a scandalous duel.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how he ended up there, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Because right before that, they talk about how he touches a scar that's on his cheek as he turns to leave. He clapped his hat on his head. He touched his cheek, where the darker line of a scar sliced across the ruddy skin, a memento of the scandalous duel that had sent him into exile at Ardsmuir. So he's like passing the torch. He's like, my time's over. Here you go. People get shunted off to.
It's a place where everyone is a prisoner.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
A place of punishment.
Definitely.
Lisa T. writes, so we learn that Jamie is doing just what Claire thought he would. Quote, not turning away from anything he thought was his job, unquote. Also, Harry refers to Jamie as the devil. This reminds us of the allusions to hell in previous chapters. Eileen P. writes, both Lord John Grey and Jamie are men of honor. This is a noble attribute, but can be both an advantage and a disadvantage. People will trust you because you will keep your word. Jamie often says, quote, you have my word, unquote. However, as a man of honor who lives by a code of honor, that can be used against you. For example, when we first meet Lord John as a 16-year-old in Dragonfly and Amber, he was tricked into revealing military secrets in order to prevent Jamie from raping Claire. Due to his code of honor, Lord John couldn't allow Claire to be hurt. So he not only gave information, but put his own life in peril. The end result impeded the English army and left Grey humiliated. This event is still remembered by Quarry, who relishes revealing that Jamie is now Lord John's prisoner and that Lord John will have to have the cooperation of Jamie, the chief, and spokesman of the prisoners in order to maintain control over the prison. Erica H. writes, the whole exchange between Lord John and Harry Quarry confuses me now that I've read all the Lord John books. Here it seems like they are strangers, but they actually know each other very well. Does anyone else feel this way, or am I missing something? Now, that's a very good question, Erica, because I have not read all the Lord John books.
Neither have I.
Have you guys?
Have you?
I've read one.
Yeah, I read the first one, or maybe even the first
I read The Hellfire, I think, early, like in 2000 or whenever she first came out with this Hellfire Club or whatever it was called.
Which, didn't one of them have zombies in it?
Yeah, it wasn't
the one I read.
I never read that one.
That's the only one I read, I think.
Was it Lord John and the Plague of Zombies?
Maybe.
Yeah, there's a
plague,
yes.
That? So that's actually a very good question. That's something let's put to our readers. You know, if you guys are readers, because we write so much, our listeners.
Well, you write a lot on Twitter.
Shut up.
I don't know how you condense it to 140 characters.
Oh, my goodness. Because I don't. I just tweet 170,000 times.
I wish I could condense you to 140 characters when we speak.
Not going to happen.
I know.
Erica. Erica, that's a very good question. We don't have the answer. We would ask our listeners I guess if you're listening, you're a listener. Anyone who's listening to this and hears this, what do you guys think? If Harry Quarry, the name makes me laugh. If Harry Quarry already knew Lord John, and well, vice versa, if they already knew each other, why, number one, does it seem to you guys here that they seem, you know, disjointed? Maybe like they didn't know. But if they truly have known each other before 55, how do you guys explain that? Or what do you think about that? That's a very interesting question. And of course, now I need to go read all the Lord John books.
I don't feel like they really act like they don't know each other. They just...
Well, but if they knew each other, like really knew each other, wouldn't he have already known about all of the scandalous things he was involved in?
But he's been stuck out at Ardsmuir, so he
probably
doesn't
know. Yeah, the scandal just happened.
All the news.
Recently happened. And what's his name? Harry Quarry was out there for what? 3 years? 2 years?
A year.
Something like that. Only a year?
He talks about 11 months, something or other, and how many days too long. Yeah,
that's true.
So he was out there for a year before he gets replaced by John. I don't know. They don't seem like they may have known each other, but it doesn't seem like they were actually really like close or good friends.
Exactly. No, see, I can see either way. To me, they don't necessarily seem like complete strangers, but I don't see a huge familiarity there. I will say that. They're not besties. I get that.
No. They just seem kind of indifferent to one another. Mm. Like he knows, like, okay, I'm taking over. You're passing it on. Go on your way.
Something I could maybe read into is that it could have entertained anyone who knew it and knew that that guy was the guy who was embarrassed by Red Jamie, blah, blah, blah. But it seemed that Harry went out of his way to let him know, to infer and let him know that he knew all about what happened at Preston Pans or before Preston Pans at Carrie Eric. That might be something where, okay, you know, there's that familiarity there and he knew he could get him easily. I don't know. That's the only thing that I could say.
Sidebar moment. I'm on a page that shows the chronology of all of Diana Gabaldon's books. Mm-hmm. And Lord John Grey and the Hands of the Devil was after Voyager. And then The Private Matter is after that one. And The Hands of the Devil is after that one. They are all squished in between Voyager and The Scottish Prisoner. And then Plague of Zombies is right before Drums of Autumn.
Okay, but that doesn't answer the question.
But if all of those things happened after Voyager, they might have not ever met before.
What I'm trying to say is we haven't read the books. In the books, if let's say they met in the books, right? The scene she's thinking of is in a book after Voyager. They may, in that book, reference, maybe not a friendship, but they may reference in that book that they knew each other for 10 years. I'm just saying we don't know. But we can definitely say, like you said,
well, if all the Lord John books come after Voyager, then this was their first meeting, or it could possibly have been their first meeting. And then if he shows up in the other books and they act like, well, they've known each other, yeah, of course they knew each other because they could have possibly met at Ardsmuir or have even known each other before that.
I could definitely go with that. All I'm saying is it still doesn't leave this perhaps small possibility that even though they take place physically after Voyager, there may be a conversation that relates or points to this place that I don't know about or this time that I can't tell you because I haven't read them, that they refer to something before 55 is what I'm saying. But you see what I'm saying? I have no evidence of that. I'm just saying maybe that's what Erica's thinking of. But you're absolutely right. If the books appeared, not even were written, if the books are chunked right there after Voyager, then the easiest and, you know, Occam's razor, right? The easiest thing is likely the easiest easiest answer is usually the answer, the most likely answer. Likely, their meeting in Voyager was the first. That would make sense to me. If she's thinking in Lord John books that they already knew each other, that could have been very well in Voyager.
Yeah.
But it could be, they could reference something else that we don't know what she's talking about.
They could have known each other in society before
Ardsmuir.
Before Voyager. There's not enough in their conversation to let the reader know whether they knew each other before this or not. They seem to be a little bit familiar. I mean, the way that Harry is kind of like taunting him a little bit with the fact that he knows about the incident when he was 16. Mm-hmm. But it could just be that's how Harry is. And he's like, I feel like kind of teasing this guy. I don't know.
Yeah, it's interesting. But now it kind of makes me want to read them. I don't have time right now, but I definitely want to read the John books one day. All of the John books one day. So meanwhile, back in the prison, Jamie is sort of dealing with a spat among the prisoners. So the men huddle together, as there's only room for six, we're told, in front of the fire. Now, they agreed that whoever had, who was going to tell a story or sing a song would have the place by the hearth. And McDoove called this bard right, the bard right. So we can see that Jamie brings civility to the prisoners, to the prison. Some organization, some structure. So they have the rules by, you know, the government troops, the British or the English, whatever, the people who are, yeah, you can't say English, the government. The government there are the soldiers, the guards, everything. They have rules, right? You get up at this time, you eat at this time, you go do your labor, you come back, you know, you can do this, you can't do this, you can't, whatever.
Yeah.
They have rules that are imposed upon them, but Jamie imposes, and not unwelcomely, Jamie helps keep internal order among them so that they acquiesce to the things that they need to do. But he helps give them that, I want to say guidance. He helps give them that leadership. And that leadership is important because he's one of theirs. So we find out that McDoove, Jamie, never takes his place beside the hearth. Someone asks Jamie if he'll speak with the new guy, meaning the new governor. And we also learn that the rats are getting quite bad. And that's kind of gross.
Yeah.
That's kind of really gross. And I learned a new word, the word sennight. I was thinking, oh, it's another word for like fortnight is 2 weeks, you know, maybe it means like 6 weeks. I don't know. No, according to Merriam-Webster, sennight is an archaic word that means week. So it just means week. Go figure. Jamie says he won't approach the new governor, but if he's invited for a meeting, he will bring up the rats. We also learn there is no doctor, but there is a man named Morrison who was allowed to go around to the cells to tend to the sick or injured. And Jamie has passed on some of Claire's knowledge regarding herbs. Here, the example is milk thistle. He tells them to, he like tells them how to prepare it, what to do, and if the guys won't eat it, then to do this and all this stuff. And he says, do it because this will help prevent scurvy. And so this is straight up from Claire.
Did you Google it?
I thought you said.
The symbolism of milk thistle?
Oh, no. I thought you said, like, did you poop it? I'm like, what?
I got it. I didn't say that at all.
Not at all. Google it. No, what is the symbolism? I can't believe I didn't look it up. Did you Google it?
No, I didn't, but I was just wondering if you went to religioussymbology.org or whatever that place you
Summer,
went to last time.
I don't
time.
Go to religioussymbology.org. You're such a dork. Hold on, but I'm Googling it now.
I'm fairly sure you did at one point. I was like, where did you find that? You're like,
in my head.
Catholic smattering.
Oh, Summer. No, but Summer, you know, again, I don't look up at Catholic or religious sites. I type in symbolism of whatever, and a lot of times it is religious symbolism, and so the top hits many times are religious sites. Here,
thistle, it says it stands for endurance, unity, and victory.
But that's a regular thistle and not a milk thistle.
Okay, so milk thistle, according to God as, here we go, godasagardener.com.
There it is.
Okay, one thistle present in Israel for thousands of years is this, the blessed milk thistle. Milk thistles have both spines and thorns. Milk thistle is adapted to dry, hot, sunny areas to include waste areas. In most areas, milk thistle is considered an invasive, noxious weed. Mm-hmm. Blah, blah, blah. I'm trying to look for symbolism. Dude, I don't want to hear from you. Go away. You're either going to give it to me or you're not, but don't play like that.
Oh, this is cute. I'm not going to give it to you.
That I could do. That's just not going to come up. Oh, yeah, well, okay. Thistle, but I put milk thistle, dude.
So did I, and everything I got is pulling up thistle.
Me too. Okay, let's just scrap it. Ellen G. writes, Jamie was the leader in there, taking care of the men, their squabbles, their health. He never really had time for himself until all of the men had gone to sleep. Now, the men, of course, are thinking about the new governor, about Governor Gray. they were talking about his age. They knew he was young from what people had seen or what had been reported, and they thought, now, young could be good or bad. So older men were typically prejudiced against the Highlanders. Quote, a scared younger soldier, though, trying to keep abreast of an unfamiliar job could be more rigid and tyrannical than the crustiest of old colonels, unquote. So they're not, they really, there aren't, they don't feel like they have a free ride quite yet. Well, there is no free ride in Ardsmuir because it's a prison, but they're not sure what to expect. They haven't let down their guard yet because they don't, they are not trusting the fact that just because he's young means he's, you know, nice or lenient or anything like that. Jamie, we find out, is in chains, and they don't bother him too much except when he has to work. And he's not able to spread his arms more than 18 inches apart, and they chafed him when he worked. So those are the two things. So it's annoying, you can't fully stretch, and they did chafe as he was working. Lisa T. writes, we meet several of the prisoners in the next scene. Quote, better the devil you can than the devil you don't, unquote. Again, references to the devil and hell, except from the perspective of the prisoners, the governor of Ardsmuir. Prison is the devil. The next scene, Lord John Grey is writing a letter to his mama. He's telling her about his new station, the haggis he had, and the weather. He tells her he'll write more soon.
Or the haggis he didn't have. Didn't he send it back?
That's true. He did. Yeah.
Loser.
So he wonders.
Delicious.
He wonders if he should ask her about George. Something must have happened with this George. Quote, promising young officers in the good graces of their superiors were not sent to the arse end of Scotland to oversee the renovation of a small and unimportant prison fortress, unquote. Another reference to Scotland as arse. It had been, quote, an unfortunate affair of the heart, unquote. His brother had told their mom. Hal, of course, was his brother. At the thought of Red Jamie, he felt himself flush as waves of heat rolled over him. But it was not the nearness of the fire. Unquote.
Do you think it was embarrassment heat, or was he maybe remembering him very fondly? Fondly.
Okay, now who's going to start looking up stuff that has to do with plants?
Yeah. Because I said fondly?
Yep.
I think it's just embarrassment.
I think it's embarrassment,
too. He was so young, and he felt like he had been made a complete fool of by Jamie, and it just still burns him up to this day that he made such a stupid mistake assuming Claire was their captive.
Well, you know? And then you wonder if that was the catalyst that sent him down a successive line of things that happened in his life. Like, if that one thing hadn't happened, would he have done X, Y, and Z? So...
yeah.
It was clearly a turning point in his life.
So before John goes to bed, he takes the bottle of whiskey from the lower drawer with him. Now John tries to sleep, but he couldn't. And he kept getting, quote, a vision of the wood at Carrieric, unquote. And of course, this was where he met Jamie. He was remembering the time he first met Jamie Fraser. He was 16, uncommissioned, with his 20-year-old brother, a lieutenant. He was gutsy, wanting to impress, perhaps. Quote, when he saw the Highlander in the wood and recognized him from the broadsheets as the notorious Red Jamie Fraser, he had determined to kill or capture him, unquote. And he had attempted this alone. Now, he describes the struggle. He says there was a knife, a hold, a struggle. John, quote, flung himself over in bed, hot with remembrance, unquote. So, yeah, this was definitely not hot to trot. This is embarrassment.
Anger.
Hotness. Yeah. They fought, they tumbled, and he had broken his arm in as he was being held. And then
He broke his own arm.
Trying to struggle.
I know. Can you imagine pulling so hard that you break your own arm?
No, it makes me nauseous.
No, but I've never been in a situation where death was an option.
That's yeah.
True. So, I mean, if death was an option, I might very well break my own arm. Like animals that shoo their feet and hands off to get out of traps. We'll just call him, like... the ultimate bear trap.
Whoa, huh? Who's the bear trap? Jamie or John?
Jamie.
I'd call John a bear trap.
John is not a bear trap. I don't know that he's into the fuzzies.
Okay. And then there was the woman. He didn't know her name was Claire, of course. But Jamie and Claire... at different levels of commitment, had played the scene in front of him. He had been mortified once he found out that they were married, and she was truly, she was not involved in that. She was not, you know, she was taken by surprise. But yeah, once he found out they were married, he was mortified that he had been played. And to not be killed, Diana tells us, almost made it worse. So to have to live with that shame. And then he tells us he had been a pariah. Only his brother and Hector had spoken to him. He had died at Culloden, Hector had. Quote, and still John woke in the dawn sometimes, body arched in clutching spasm, feeling Hector's touch, unquote.
Can we talk for a second about names?
Hold on, hold on. Then he says, quote, and now this, unquote. I wrote, he's affected by Red Jamie, maybe? And I think at this point, because he's just getting shiver me timbers thinking of Hector, I mean, I don't know that he's connected it, but I know he was embarrassed and all that stuff and a pariah and had to live with the shame of Cary Eric. And then he's remembering his lover, Hector. And I mean, hello, you can't be more clear by the word spasms. He was remembering the embarrassment with Jamie, the spasms from Hector, in pleasure most likely, and Hector's death at Culloden, and now he's saying, and now Red Jamie Fraser. So he went from embarrassment to spasms of pleasure to Jamie. So they may not have originated together. I'm thinking now they're mushing together.
I mean, it's a very complicated relationship. But that being said, I would like to go back to the names.
Yes.
I'm fairly sure there were more than five names in Scotland over the course of time. The fact that there are now two characters named Hector. Isn't Hector Cameron?
We haven't met him yet, but yes.
I know, but I'm just thinking there's a wealth of names that she could have gone with for fictional characters. To keep reusing names kind of seems like overkill.
Well, and I remember when I was first read these books, his brother being named Harold, and then the guy, his lover, was Hector. It was like, that confused the hell out of me. I kept thinking, wait, is he having like a sex, did he have a sexual relationship with his brother that died? And then I realized, oh, wait, that's Hector is not his brother.
Is
that was that Harold.
What
and,
killed him?
No, I'm just like sitting there like, didn't we already have that? Like, well, we didn't have that, but we had like, you know, Jack Black, who had...
Jack Black, that's an actor.
Or Blackjack.
Sorry. Blackjack?
You know what I meant.
Guys, Lene needs a little bit of time to ease her way back into this podcasting thing.
I'm so tired today, y'all. I am so tired. You have
it's
no
been
idea.
It's actually been a pretty nasty
I've had a long day. Anyway, but no, Blackjack, you know, his like kind of unnatural, like he loved his brother, but to the point it was like creepy.
I mean, those things might also be true for Jack Black. To be honest, I don't know. We could definitely ask him
personally. But
neither do we. So
he might have a very complicated relationship with his brother.
I don't know. Maybe.
I have a pretty complicated relationship with my sister.
That's true.
Not like Summer. We are not that complicated.
Not like that. Thank God.
Oh, second note.
I don't think I could be your guy's friend.
Exactly. See, every time you're not that complicated.
Every time you say Cary Eric or whatever the name is.
Cary Eric.
Yeah, I keep thinking. Curio Yulazen, that song from the
80s. Oh, Lord.
And the road that I must travel.
Oh, is that funny?
Curio Yulazen in the darkness of the night.
Why do we know these words?
Oh, my God. Oh, no. I got an 80s album, and that was on it. It's on it. It's hilarious. I'm just like, oh, my gosh.
Oh, my
this
God.
Is like an anthem in the 80s. Anyway, moving on.
Back to Outlander. I mean, Voyager.
Ellen G. writes, I take it that Hector was John's first lover. Okay, that's Ginger making fun. Not that's not what Ellen G. wrote.
They never state that it was his first lover. He talks about
it. But he gave him spasms, Lene.
I know, but they talk like he was his first love.
Look, bitches.
That's true.
My first lover didn't give me spasms, so let's not be mutually exclusive.
But with guys, it's pretty easy. Come on.
And I hesitate to call the first one a lover in any way, shape, or form. It was
he
more
was
like
my
a,
the Saturday Night Live couple. Then
my lover,
my lover, my lover, come my lover. let's go.
Get the hell off. And they always ended like that. Anyway.
Okay, back to Ellen G.
Sorry.
Ellen G writes, I take it that Hector was John's first lover, and he still mourns his death at Culloden. Now, John never thought that he would have met Jamie again. And here he is. Ava D. writes, Lord John Grey reflects that he is a man of honor, which reminds me of another opposite man who would stake the same claim, Black Jack Randall. It was their sense of honor that held BJR and Jamie together in Wentworth Prison, with Jamie at the mercy of BJR. However, now Jamie is at the mercy of another, quote, man of honor, unquote. This time, Lord John Grey. We see the heart of Lord John Grey in the way he thinks about those at his mercy, in his care. He is a kind and loving person, a kindred soul to Jamie in his sense of responsibility and care for others. He is also a foil for the depraved black soul of Jack Randall. Where Randall treats those at his mercy with destruction, Grey treats those in his care with whatever kindness is available to him. Joe B. writes, in introducing more of Lord John's backstory, we see Culloden as a place of tragic loss and grief for him as well, in his loss of Hector, and it is the beginnings of the similarities of Lord John and Jamie that will be explored as the story moves on. In our obvious focus on Jacobitism, and especially Jamie, it's easy to forget that the government troops had families who grieved as well. Lord John is a wonderful counterpoint and reminder of the complexity of the aftermath of the war. And that's very true as well. Lisa T. writes, in the next scene, Lord John recalls his first meeting with Red Jamie before Preston Pans. He still feels humiliated. The irony in the scene that he recalls is that it is a direct parallel to the scene in Outlander when Jamie rescues Claire from BJR. Lord John is trying to rescue Claire from Jamie, who half strips her just as BJR did. Lord John is mortified that Jamie played him for the fool. We also learn that his lover, Hector, died at Culloden. Quote, hacked to pieces by a Highland broadsword, and still John woke in the dawn sometimes, body arched in clutching spasm, feeling Hector's touch, unquote. So just as Jamie lost Claire at Culloden, so Lord John lost his love, Hector. We understand why both Jamie and Lord John, Scots and English, both have a reason to hate one another. The next morning, he does what has to be done. Jamie is there, and neither of them could leave. They would deal with it. Insight as to Grey's feelings about Big Red? Quote, while it was the memory of his past rage and humiliation that had kept
him awake. Wait. We can't let that pass.
Big Red?
Big Red?
Yes, Big Jamie.
Red Jamie and Big Red are not the same thing.
That's not the same thing.
One is the
chewing gum. But he's big and he's red.
Big Red's not Jamie.
Red Jamie. Big Red is so inappropriate.
Quote, while it was the memory of his past rage and humiliation that had kept him awake to begin with, it was the other side of the present situation that had left him still awake at dawn, unquote. That Jamie was now his prisoner at his mercy. He imagined Fraser at his mercy, and he reveled in it. And then he felt self-disgust. Quote, whatever he might once have been to Grey, Fraser now was a beaten foe, a prisoner of war, and the charge of the crown. He was Grey's charge, in fact, a responsibility, and his welfare, the duty of honor, unquote. So this is another reference to honor, as in the title, Honor's Prisoner. So they're both, I mean, Jamie would never have gotten to prison if he hadn't given himself up, and the reason he did that is because of a huge sense of honor and obligation and everything to keep his people safe. And of course, John is there, he's there as a punishment, but he's not doing anything. John is a prisoner of his own honor, because otherwise he could be a tyrant, but he's not. Ellen G. writes, so, Grey made the decision not to see Jamie privately, only during roll call. Remember the previous commander saying to bring him to dinner every week to liaise with him for the prisoners. He wanted to keep the feelings he was having at a minimum. Then he had the thought that Jamie was his prisoner, not his tormentor, and is entirely at his mercy. Grey seeing in his mind's eye Jamie confined to a cell of freezing stone, kept naked through the winter's nights, fed on slops, stripped and flogged in the courtyard of the prison. By the way, Grey had never seen Jamie's back, had he?
Uh-uh.
He remembered that as long as Jamie was his prisoner, he could not in honor harm him. Now, Grey also realizes that his debt to Fraser has been discharged through the saving of his life by his brother. So that debt, he actually, I mean, he's a man of honor, and that's what's keeping him, you know, from not doing stuff. But as far as the debt goes, that's done.
But is it, though? Because it was paid by his brother. Does he not personally owe him something on his own?
I think John definitely feels something, but technically it was paid back. But yes, I could definitely see that argument. Lisa T. writes, Jamie has gone through all of that at the hands of a very different redcoat, BJR. The fact that we know that Jamie had already suffered through that, though Lord John doesn't, makes it all the more horrible when Lord John contemplates revenge. But ultimately, Lord John is a man of honor and not unlike Jamie. Quote, Fraser's sheer helplessness as a prisoner made him completely safe. All the Greys were men of honor, unquote. He was overwhelmed by paperwork, as Quarry had warned, and he knew he'd need to hire a new clerk soon. He's sitting with his supper, and he's visited by a rat. He asks, is it Mackay, for that a cat be brought up from the storeroom? And because of his experience there with the rat that comes up to his supper, and he's like, oh, my God, you know, throws the book at it or throws whatever at it, and, of course, he misses it. But because of that, he asks that a cat be brought or be put into one cell, one cat in each cell, to help keep the rat population down in the prison.
Well, first and he calls for one for his room.
Yes.
And then he was like, well.
He asks the prisoner that's in there serving.
If it's really bad, yeah.
He's like, how are the rats down in the prison? He goes, oh, not so good. You know, I mean, they've gotten pretty bold. And then that's when he says, well, let's get a cat for each cell.
Yeah.
I like that he says, God damn my eyes.
Though, to be honest, rat. Listening to Ginger's cats right now makes me think it's a terrible idea.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So Mackay says that the rats do keep down the cockchafers.
Yeah, what is that?
And they look adorable.
They're adorable. Like, look, I don't want one near my cockchafer.
Look how cute he is.
What the hell is that?
I love his little ear bangle things, whatever those are, antennae.
What is it?
It's a bug that apparently chafes their cocks. I have nothing else to tell you.
That's
what it's called.
I mean, do they house themselves inside of...
I mean, I think they just get on your body.
Clearly, they're called cockchafers for a reason. They prefer the cock and balls region of a man's body?
I guess that's where we're going? So, I mean, it must... The name came from somewhere. So, the rats actually help keep down the bug population. So, that's, you know, that's like... You want to keep maybe a few around. But Mackay says that the men would be upset if all the rats were killed. And he finds out, yes, they do actually eat the rats, but only when they're lucky enough to catch one. So maybe the cats would be helpful after all.
That's kind of gross.
I know. It's kind of nasty.
Kind of disgusting.
Either way, either you have the cockchafers or you have...
I mean, but he looks so pleasant.
Eat the rats. Well, he does.
No.
But I don't think he talks. It's a really close-up. He may be, like, ugly and nasty from
feet away. He looks like a Pokemon is what he looks like.
Oh, my goodness.
And you don't like Pokemon?
He looks like a creepy Pokemon.
Look, you've been burned by Pokemon in your past.
I have bad
I know you don't care for Pokemon, but not all Pokemon are bad.
I don't care. There are
bad ones and good ones.
I'm not a fan of bugs. Anything that crawls on me, I'm not about that. I don't care how cute it is up close.
Ellen G. writes, Mackay tells Gray that the rats kept the cockchafers down. Lovely, isn't he? Just like our June bugs here. They appear in late April and can be seen and heard, flying into lit windows and even lamps. And Ellen G. is actually the one that gave us the picture of the cockchafer that we will share in our show notes.
So isn't something that crawls on their body. It's like some kind of bug that flies around inside the cell annoying them.
Well, it sounds like it flies around inside of their cocks. I mean, it's a cockchafer.
I know, but if it's
name
like...
name came from somewhere.
If it's like a beetle or a bug, I mean, that looks like a fairly large bug.
Or it's just a really high-res camera.
It could be.
That's true.
But it's on a leaf. Shaper. It's not on...
It could be a tiny leaf, like a fern.
Yeah, but have you seen up close pictures of a flea or lice? It doesn't look like that. You know what I mean?
Let's find out.
How big are they? They're a beetle called the Maybug or
doodlebug. Aww, the doodlebug.
So they are a beetle. They're just the head looked really furry and
Here's
creepy
one.
Looking.
Close up of a male cockchafer.
Yeah.
Showing the 7 leaves on the antenna, which you'll all see when we post this on the
So what do they do though? What do they do? Like, what do they eat?
Oh, okay. For real, it says adults of the common cockchafer reach sizes of 25 to 30 millimeters. The forest cockchafer is a little smaller, 20 to 25 millimeters. The two species can be best distinguished by the form of their tail end. It is long and slender in the common cockchafer, but shorter and knob-shaped in the end of the forest cockchafer. Both have brown color. Male cockchafers have 7 leaves on their antenna, where the females only have 6.
So you're going to sit there and count the leaves?
Apparently. Somebody did.
If they're in prison, that's all you have time for.
Well, why would they care about these bugs being in the cell with them unless they're pests somehow?
I'm telling you, the name came from somewhere. It didn't come out of women.
They feed on plants and roots, potato roots. The grubs develop into the earth for 3 to 4 years.
Well, maybe Google, how did cockchafers get their name? I mean, come on.
I'm looking.
Okay, you're right. It's a cockchafer beetle.
20 millimeters? That's the small one?
Yeah.
That's like almost an inch, I bet. That's a big beetle. That's way bigger than like...
This is really weird. I think, yeah, you're right. So FAQs on this habitas.org.uk. How did cockchafer beetle get its name? The name cockchafer is Old English for big beetle, while Käfer is German for beetle. Now, that's correct. The beetle belongs to the scarab beetle family. Scarabaeidae.
Yeah, it looks like a scarab.
But, so... I get the Käfer bit. So the chafer, I can see that being coming from Käfer, but I don't get cock. Is cock supposed to be big?
I mean, it could reference chickens.
Yeah, cockchafers, they're big beetles. These are big beetles they're talking about. They're like...
So the name didn't come from...
30 millimeters? That's a big beetle. That's a
really
big beetle.
Yeah, okay. Well, so maybe they're just annoying it like in front of the fire or something. Because at some...
No, that's true.
It just sounds like it shouldn't have been a bother, but they were a bother, or else the guy wouldn't have said, oh, but they do keep that population down, which sounds like it would be a bonus in some way.
Yeah, yeah.
But Deborah C. writes, Diana does a great job of describing the physical and psychological desolation of Ardsmuir prison. Quote, the carbuncle on God's bum, unquote, and prisoners don't run because there's, quote, nowhere to go, unquote. And of the prisoners. Butcher Billy made sure that the Highlanders lost their will, their, quote, docile, unquote.
Wait, who's Butcher Billy? What's that nickname for?
William Cumberland.
Yeah, okay.
There was, quote, no heart in them after Culloden, unquote. And the prisoners were worked so hard, quote, no vigor left for troublemaking, unquote. And, quote, the prisoners eat rats when they're lucky enough to catch one, unquote. Eileen P. writes, Gray fantasizes about retribution toward Jamie, but concludes that as a man of honor, he cannot in good conscience do so. It is his duty to care for the prisoners. They are at his mercy. And as a man of honor, he will not abuse that power. Quote, for whether foolish or wise, naive or experienced, all the Grays were men of honor, unquote. Perhaps this attribute of honor is both innate and learned. Joe B. writes, we met Lord John again in a position of power. We meet Jamie again in a position of diminished authority, a reversal of their first meeting. Although Jamie, being Jamie, is rarely completely without some sort of control, even if it's only of himself. MacDuve, the name referring to his father, reinforces the role as Laird, Jamie Fraser, son of Black Brian, and he's got his clan again. Joe B. also asks, is there any historical proof that people in prison ain't rats? It's such a pervasive cliche of historical prisons. It seems likely, but I couldn't find any authoritative reference. That's also another good question. I don't know, but yeah, it's like in all the movies you see or in plays or in stories that are, if anything set in a 18th or earlier century prison, it's like you always hear, if nothing else, rats are crawling around.
Mm-hmm. So if anyone has any information... Free protein. Come on. They're not being fed very well. They're prisoners.
Much. Lisa T. writes, this little moment is interesting because despite Lord John's position, he is still in a hellish place, even if he has a fireplace and food. He shares it with vermin. And finally, Martina P. writes, Jamie is now a prisoner, but the inmates treat him like a laird. In a way, the prison cell represents Lallybroch, and the prisoners are his tenants. He does not demand this kind of respect, however. Wherever Jamie goes, the people surrounding him put him in this leadership position. They blindly follow him. Even the guards and the commanders respect him and treat him with dignity. Nothing seems to take place in this prison without Jamie's quiet blessing.
That was chapter 8. So join us next week when we discuss chapter 9, entitled The Wanderer.
So thank you, as always. Thank you, Lene, for joining us. And thank you, dear listener, as always, so much for joining us. We look forward to our next episode.
Thank you to our generous audio host, Audioboom.com. Our Audioboom channel is www.audioboom.com/channel/Outlander Pod. Visit our website at www.outlanderpod.com. Follow us on Twitter at Outlander Pod. Find us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/OutlanderPod, or email us at outlanderpod@gmail.com. That my young love